If you think about it, we're in the middle of the worst housing crisis we have seen, certainly in my lifetime. You know, during the Great Recession 15 years ago, you know, the crisis was largely a foreclosure crisis, and homeowners were losing their homes at record levels, and capital markets froze up for a time, and took the world several years to work out of that. But since then, the crisis has really become more of a rental housing crisis, and that's the world that we all swim in primarily. And
welcome to Buzz House, a Baker Tilly podcast where you can hear all the buzz around multifamily housing with all the info you need to help you win now and anticipate tomorrow. Hi, I'm Don Bernards, the partner in charge of Baker Tilly's multifamily housing practice.
And I'm Gary Gibson, a partner at Baker Tilly, also specializing in consulting on multifamily housing transactions across the country.
Let's get started. A little over 4 years ago, we held a webinar about just 1 month into COVID, the COVID pandemic, of course, which included today's guest on the Buzz House. That webinar was the impetus for kicking us off on this podcast series, which we're now a little bit over 100 episodes into the series. So thank you, first of all, for all of our listeners. Second of all, thank you very much for our guest today, Brian Swanton. Brian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Brian, of course, is president and CEO of Gorman & Company, a fully integrated developer of affordable and workforce housing, who was seventh in this year's Affordable Housing Finance's top 50 developers for units developed during the last year. So Brian, congratulations on that as well.
Thank you.
For this episode of the Buzz House, Garrick and I wanted to catch up with Brian on what trends and opportunities he has seen, you know, since the pandemic, what challenges have stayed with us or exacerbated by the pandemic. Have they changed the way they've, you know, running their business since the pandemic? And what's next in this current environment, and maybe even the next over the next 3 to 5 years? And finally, what legislatively, you know, would be helpful, and talk a little bit about that. So a lot of catching up to do, and looking forward to the discussion. With that, I'm going to turn over to Garrick to kick things off. Garrick?
All right. Thanks, Don. And Brian, thanks for joining us again. Before we get into some questions, would you please let our listeners know a little bit more about Gorman & Company?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you both very much for having me back, gentlemen. And congrats on over 100 episodes. That's really incredible. And I can't believe I was your very first guest, honestly. That's pretty great. And this production has come so far since that first primitive COVID episode. So being back after 100 episodes is pretty special. So thanks for having me on. So Gorman & Company, we're celebrating a major milestone as well this year. We're celebrating our 40th year in business, if you can believe that. I've been with the company for the last 16 years, so a little less than half that time. And Gary Gorman founded the company back in 1984. I remind Gary all the time that his CEO was 10 years old when he started the firm. He doesn't like hearing that, of course, because it makes him feel old, but I say it anyway. And Gary started the firm after a short stint as a lawyer. He started doing small acquisition rehab transactions of multifamily properties in rural Wisconsin using the historic tax credit. This was 2 years before the federal housing credit was introduced, of course. And then when the Tax Reform Act of 86 was signed by President Reagan, Gary began twinning the historic credit with the housing credit. And those were some of the first twinned historic LIHTC deals in the country, actually. He started the company with small loans from friends and family, and raising tax credit equity from high net worth individuals and such. And in fact, he was famously called out by our friends at Boston Financial for having his 10-speed bicycle on his balance sheet in the early days. And that's a true story. I'm not sure if it was listed as an asset or a liability, actually. But our firm started with some humble beginnings, for sure. And it's really incredible to see what Gary was able to build over the years. He's now the chairman of the board and still plays an active role in the firm. But he handed the reins over to me 6.5 years ago, and it's really been a fun ride so far. Today, as you mentioned, Gorman & Company is the seventh largest producer of affordable housing in the country, and we're coming off of our biggest year in our company's history, which we're super proud about. We have 8 core markets and regions that we operate today across the country, each of those with market presidents that lead those markets, most of whom are shareholders in the firm as well, which is really great. We're a vertically integrated firm as well, so we have fully licensed affiliated businesses at Gorman, including architecture, construction, and property management divisions. So we don't just develop our projects, we also design them, we build them, and manage them also. We also own 3 hotels in Wisconsin and Illinois that we operate with our management team. Not a lot of people know that about us. All 3 of our hotels are signature historic adaptive reuse projects using state federal historic credits. We've also used new markets, tax credits, EB-5 financing, and a variety of other tools for those hotels as well. So we're up to about 700 employees now and really in a major growth phase of our business. So yeah, we've been able to take Gary's Bicycle off of the company balance sheet, which is nice.
Thank you for that background info, Brian, especially the bike. I think you mentioned that to me before, but it always amuses me when I hear it. So let's dive into our questions. For our first question, you know, we're seeing a consistent trend over 2020 where you have a growing and extreme need for units of housing, especially affordable. So what are the trends your company has seen over the last 3 to 4 years in things like federal, state, local financing, perhaps construction, maybe some zoning, and have those trends actually led to opportunities?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I often tell people we're in the best of times and the worst of times all at the same time. You know, it's really an interesting time for me to be in the affordable housing business. And I think you guys would agree. It's just things change almost daily, it seems, in our marketplace. If you think about it, we're in the middle of the worst housing crisis we have seen, certainly in my lifetime. You know, during the Great Recession 15 years ago, you know, the crisis was largely a foreclosure crisis and homeowners were losing their homes at record levels and capital markets froze up for a time and took the world several years to work out of that. But since then, the crisis has really become more of a rental housing crisis, and that's the world that we all swim in primarily. And the seeds of which were actually planted back in the Great Recession, actually, we experienced monumental job growth for years, and we've had 15 years of historically low interest rates, which hit all-time lows during the COVID pandemic, of course. Real estate was relatively cheap during this time, so everyone who could was buying a home. You know, over the last 15 years, including large multinational corporations who are buying up entire portfolios of homes and renting them out. So many households who were renting, including those who had foreclosures and short sales on their record, they had the opportunity to at least rent a home until they got their credit back in order. So, but we simply weren't producing enough multifamily product across the country, and we certainly weren't entitling enough land for multifamily use. When the pre-COVID building boom hit, most of the new multifamily production was high-end luxury product. It's really unattainable to most in the workforce. So then comes COVID, right? And we have all these homeowners in place refinancing their homes at rates so low today that, my goodness, we have divorced couples still living with each other because their mortgage rates are so affordable. And other than luxury apartments and LIHTC-financed rental projects, there's almost no new rental housing being built during this time period for the missing middle. And these people who locked into historically low interest rates, they're not selling their homes, which has sort of frozen the resale market in many ways. And so this lack of rental production has become a real serious problem. It's driving up the number of homeless and unhoused in this country to the largest number in American history. I think we have about 650,000 individuals at last count that are unhoused today in this country. It's just unbelievable. So how do we respond to this? Well, you know, the good news is that housing affordability is really top of mind in American households. Yeah, I talk to a lot of elected officials in my work and I speak to them, and they mentioned to me that time and again, housing affordability has been the number one or number two issue they hear from their constituents. So this is kind of causing them to do a deep dive into the issue to try and find solutions. Some of those solutions make great sense and others, well, not so much, but at least the issue is front and center. And as I think about it, when I started in this business 30 years ago, affordable rental housing just wasn't on the table as a major political issue, right? I remember meeting with Senator John McCain in his office in Phoenix many years ago, trying to advocate for the expansion of the federal housing credit. He kept thinking I was talking about the mortgage interest deduction. I mean, no one was talking about affordable rental housing back then. Today, it's one of the top issues in the country. So this attention has led to significant legislation that's trying to tackle this crisis. You know, a lot of it's coming at the state and local level, which is really deep. The most effective tool, I think, is the groundswell of state housing tax credit programs that largely mimic the federal credits. And I know you guys were just discussing this Texas state LIHTC program a few episodes ago. And what's really great is that both red states and blue states are creating these programs all over the country. I think we're between 20 and 30 states now with the state LIHTC, and they're producing literally tens of thousands of new units that wouldn't otherwise get built with just federal credit alone. So, of course, the flip side is that it's gobbling up a lot of the volume cap in many states. So hopefully we can get a reduction in the 50% bond test to free up more volume cap for 4% transactions in states that are consistently running out. Also seeing legislation at the state and local levels, as you mentioned, focus on zoning reform from tiny house and accessory dwelling unit ordinances, zoning by right bills, which are highly controversial, but we're seeing more and more of those. Even the elimination of single-family zoning in places like Minneapolis and other communities, trying to tackle the problem through land use. I always say that the number one problem we face as affordable housing developers is the availability of financial resources, but entitlement and zoning issues are definitely number two.
Brian, thank you very much for that. And that kind of really leads into our next question, right? We, again, in the very first podcast, we talked about the immediate issues during COVID and the pandemic, and obviously things and construction costs and other things maybe were exacerbated by COVID. What are some of the maybe obvious, maybe some are not so obvious, what have the challenges been in the last, 3 to 4 years since you're on the show? And then, I know no one has a crystal ball, right? But what do you see the next 12, 24 months? Do you see those challenges lifting or not necessarily?
Yeah, I started my career with Gorman & Company on July 1st of 2008. And we all know what happened a few months after that. The sky was literally falling. The capital markets completely froze up. So, when COVID hit, we went into overdrive and thought sort of we'd see a replica of what happened during the Great Recession. And luckily, it wasn't quite as bad as we all feared. A lot of people, unfortunately, lost their lives and became very ill and that sort of thing. But from an economic standpoint, things kept moving, especially in the affordable housing space. But again, it's the best of times and the worst of times, right? It's honestly, I think we've entered into a phase that I call the new normal. During COVID, well, the sky wasn't really as falling as much as we feared. Global inflation was just clobbering all of us, right? For 2 years, I don't think I had a single project that wasn't getting hammered with massive inflationary pressures, and not to mention supply chain and labor issues as well on top of that. So we always seem to find a solution, but costs were rising so fast, we just couldn't keep up with it. Subcontractors were only holding their bid numbers for 24 hours, and we've replaced more subs during construction than I care to admit back then, because they too are wrestling with the same issues. And while costs have settled in and have become more predictable, they really haven't come down that much, right? Just as the cost of one commodity drops, it seems the cost of another one spikes even today. So it's sort of evened itself out, but I think the current cost environment is really here to stay, at least until the next major market disruption hits. So we better get used to it. We've also seen some positive, though, offsetting factors that have helped us keep producing since the pandemic hit. Of course, rates were ridiculously low up until last year, so now that party is over. ARPA funding and other stimulus funds, they're flowing into the system as well, although much of that's now drying up also. Income averaging was brought back, and fair market rents have really been on the rise across the country as well, all of which has really helped counteract some of those post-COVID challenges. But I think the one lingering issue post-COVID that I worry about the most is insurance. The cost of builders' risk during construction, and more importantly, the cost of property and liability coverage on the operations side is literally crippling the industry. And, the New York Times just profiled this issue on Friday, actually, and it's just simply unsustainable. If there is legislation, I think, that our industry needs to work on, it's some form of comprehensive insurance relief for affordable housing. With climate change and the increase in the number of natural disasters, I just don't see an end in sight on the increase of insurance costs. And so we all need to find a solution before half of America's affordable housing stock ends up in foreclosure, because we can't just raise rents to solve the issue. It just doesn't work that way for us.
Thank you for buying. And yeah, Garrick and I have definitely talked about insurance, and I know there's a special hearing maybe sometime recently, and we'll talk a lot more about that. Brian, looking to the future, I know you said you're in a great growth mode right now. What do you think the next 3 to 5 years looks for you? Obviously, you've used a lot of LIHTC, you used some workforce. Is it public-private partnerships? What do you think are the keys for your continued growth for the next 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, definitely. We're doing more and more deed-restricted, non-LIHTC workforce housing for the missing middle. And I emphasize deed-restricted because I see that as a lot of people are touting that they're building workforce housing, but, you know, without those deed restrictions on there, there's, you know, no mechanism to keep it affordable long term. So, but we're doing a lot of that, especially really high cost markets and resort communities where state and local governments can really bring significant resources to the table, including tax exemptions, for instance, to help us serve this demographic sort of between the 80 to 120% of area median income level. Our market leader in Colorado, Kimball Crangle, has really been a national leader in this space. And we're now working on similar models in some of our other states where it makes sense as well. What we're finding right now is that there's lots of private equity shops out there chasing this kind of product, but getting construction financing today has really become a major obstacle for non-LIHTC development. Many of the large banks are, and medium and small banks are just not able to lend on market rate construction loans outside of their community development banking arm. So the capital markets are a bit constrained right now in that space, but we're still closing two major workforce projects this year, one in Steamboat Springs that closed last month and one in Hayden, Colorado, that is on track to close this month. And despite the challenges, we hope to do even more of this kind of workforce housing in the future to sort of supplement our tax credit work.
And shifting gears just a little bit back to kind of policy and things like that. Like you said, you work in, you know, at least eight states, major markets, things of that nature, you work in a lot of different municipalities, probably larger, some smaller. How are you, what are you seeing? What is working? What is not working? What do you think cities need to do, are doing around creating policy? Again, is it different from larger cities? Maybe they have more resources to smaller cities. Like you started out, there's need everywhere. It doesn't matter if you're a town of 10,000, a town of 2 million, there's need. What are you kind of seeing in this space?
You know, it's all about access to capital, right? And whether your community is growing rapidly or your population growth has been fairly stagnant, you still need resources to make these deals pencil and to produce new units in the low-income space. So that doesn't change regardless of where you go throughout the country. In our fast-growing cities like Phoenix and Atlanta, where we have a strong presence, you know, a lot of the focus is on incentivizing new unit production through ground-up new construction. You know, they have the resources to incentivize a lot of that type of work. Some of our more limited growth areas, maybe in the Midwest and other parts of the country, we might be more focused on public housing redevelopment or adaptive reuse of historically significant structures, for instance, to solve their community problems, while still providing, like you said, the much needed high quality housing. The strategy might be completely different from community to community, but the basic fact still remains that it takes resources and incentives to make these deals possible. That's why the federal and the state LIHTC is so powerful. It's such an incredibly flexible and creative tool that can adapt to local needs. You know, we're using the state LIHTC in Arizona, for example, to build a 368-unit, 4% ground-up new construction project. It's going to be the largest permanent supportive housing project in the U.S., or one of them. And but we're using that same state LIHTC resource to redevelop dilapidated public housing in two neighboring cities, and actually to convert a historic school in a rural area of the state into senior housing as well. So it's such a powerful and flexible resource. And so we need more of that. And but yeah, the strategies are different and the level of resources vary. But state LIHTC can really help even that out. It's like in Arizona, they'll split half of their state LIHTC pool between urban and rural communities to make sure some of that capital does get out to those harder served parts of the state.
Thanks, Brian. And you know, for my last question, kind of just continuing what you're talking about, because obviously you mentioned at the federal level or some relief with insurance, rising insurance costs possibly, and you mentioned state credits. But just in general, what would be very beneficial legislatively at the federal and state level? I mean, I assume more financial resources are a big part of that, but is there anything else?
Again, it is all about resources and access to capital. That's really it. So the most successful tool we have in this country, obviously, is the Federal Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program. I think LIHTC has created about 96% of all new affordable housing units in this country since it was created in 1986. And so we all know it works, and we need to expand it, you know, allowing for more 4% and 9% deals to get done. And, you know, we're pushing hard as an industry to make that happen. But tax credits aren't the only solution either. You know, we sometimes like to pretend that there's an unlimited amount of tax credit investor equity out there, but there isn't. You know, we have to be wary of the supply and demand curve as more federal and state credits are put to market. At some point, pricing will drop to a point where the additional credits won't be a net positive for the industry. So I'm not sure where that point is, but it's not just about housing credits. We're also competing with solar and energy credits too, and film credits and R&D credits and all of those things as well. So we need other solutions that reach beyond the credit if we're serious about solving our housing supply issues. So the credit is just a massively powerful tool, but it does have its limitations in the marketplace. Beyond financial resources, you know, I think any legislation that makes more land available for affordable housing, a lot of these land use ordinances and legislative efforts that we talked about, anything that reduces the cost of construction and the regulatory environment there, and anything that reduces operating costs for affordable housing properties, you know, especially when it comes to insurance, are always going to be a net positive for our industry. You know, these are the areas we should all be focused on, in my opinion, because we're losing ground on the demand for new units, and we have to think big if we're going to catch up.
Very good. That's it for this episode of BuzzHouse, catching up with Brian Swanton of Gorman & Company on trends, challenges, and opportunities in the market. Brian, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Once again, I'm Don Bernards.
And I'm Garrett Gibson. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. For additional resources around multifamily housing, check out BakerTilly.com. If you have a suggestion for the show, email us at buildabakertilly.com. That's BUILD@BakerTilly.com. See you next time on BuzzHouse.